Ms. Day.
Go, may I?
Yes.
Oh, okay, sorry. I'd like to point out a couple of things. First of all, the fleet services case that we cited specifically states that Guam procurement law provides for several methods of procuring and expressly mandates the use of competitive bid process unless otherwise authorized by law. All territorial contracts shall be awarded by competitive field bidding unless there are any certain exceptions which this particular procurement doesn't fall under. For instance, emergency procurement pursuant to 5215, full source, procurement of certain services under 5121, and procurement of nonprofit corporations. And so for that, I think that's important. And I think another important point is that
I'm sorry, Ms. Day, what statute was that?
I'm going to provide you with the case. I have an extra copy. It's section 5GCA 5125. And this procurement is for the procurement of services including design, architectural engineering, financing. Financing was given great weight, was given 70% of the scoring. I think that tells you how important it was. And it was an important factor because the government didn't have the funds, and they really needed a long-term financing. So I think they authorized it for 30 years, and that's why it was given a 70% weight. And maintenance, and lease, and construction. And we think that the legislature, because the legislature recognized the importance of financing, we think that this procurement, under the analysis of fleet, is a two-part test. It looks at the status of the service provider and the service of that provider, that this would weigh heavily in favor of a procurement for services under 5GCA 5121. Another point I'd like to make is that the CETA resolution didn't authorize the governor to do anything. CETA simply doesn't have the right to authorize the governor to do anything. The governor has his own counsel, he does his own review, and the governor independently as executive branch signs off on these contracts. So the argument that somehow CETA authorized the governor to do this or that, although the verbiage, some language in there, but I think we all know that CETA didn't have the power or the authority to authorize the governor to do anything. This was just a form that was a form consent that would allow the closing to occur, that the closing occurs somewhere down the road.
Mr. Cunliffe, as this is your motion, I will give you the last word if you so desire.
That's fine. That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. After hearing the arguments of the parties, are you going to say anything?
No.
He said no. Okay. After hearing the arguments of the parties, as a hearing officer, I'm going to deny the motion to reconsider on two main grounds. The Public Law 29-114 does specify an RFP. The only RFP procedure is actually set forth in 5GCA section 5216, which is the competitive selection procedures for services specified in section 5121 of this chapter. Likewise, under Guam procurement regulations, that procedure is also spelled out in 2GAR Division 4, Chapter 3, Section 3114. In addition to that, as the RFP does solicit for services that are within the scope of professional engineering and architects and architectural services, the requirements of 2GAR Division 4, section, or excuse me, TGR Division 4, Chapter 5, Section 5108C, do apply, and under that section, it specifically requires that the source selection method for engineering and architectural services is the competitive selection procedures for services. And so under those grounds, that's one of the grounds we deny the motion to reconsider. As for the second argument set out by the appellant, that there was an award of the contract, or there was an award of this, so there is no notice of award. Likewise, as set forth in our earlier decision, without complete agreement as to the contract documents, there is no award, essentially. In this case, there is no finalized leaseback agreement between the government of Guam and this and the interested party, IBC. And on those grounds, we deny the motion to reconsider. We will also spell this out in the final decision in the matter, as this is kind of part of the formal hearing. Okay? Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Camacho. I don't know if this is the right time to do this, but I think I have to bring to your attention that we did put Ms. Chrysostomo under subpoena again for today. And the reason we did that, and the reason we'd like to call her now, is to impeach her testimony. Before we subpoenaed Ms. Chrysostomo, we had to act fast because we didn't have much time. Yesterday afternoon, we got subpoenas out to GTA to bring in her handphone records, her cell phone records, to corroborate or reveal any inconsistencies between her testimony under oath and the actual records of DTA, which record the incoming and the outgoing calls that she made, and from whom the calls to her were made, and to whom she made calls. And we found some very drastic discrepancies between these records and her testimony. And I think it would behoove the nature of these proceedings to illustrate and to disclose through her live testimony today the inaccuracy of what she testified yesterday. And I'm prepared to make an offer of proof if that would be of interest.
Mr. Coleman?
I think they rested yesterday except in case I called any other witnesses. So I don't see why they should be allowed to reopen. If they'd given us all the documents they should have earlier, we'd be done by now.
2 points. We did not rest. I never said those words that we rest, first of all. It's true that at that point, the only purpose in proceeding and calling additional witnesses would be if Mr. Cunliffe called additional witnesses. I never said we rested. However, we did not know if we were going to call Mrs. Chrysostomo until we subpoenaed the records of GTA. How could we know? But we certainly feel that we have the right to impeach her testimony under oath with the undeniable records of GTA, which show conclusively that she was not being totally accurate. She was being far from accurate in her testimony.
Well, in terms of this offer of proof, would this be solely to impeach portions of her earlier testimony?
That's correct.
And nothing else?
That's correct.
Okay, on those grounds, is she here today?
She is.
Okay, on those grounds, I'm allowing the call.
Do we have somebody to authenticate the records from GTA?
Okay, do we have those? Well, before we do that, has Mr. Cunliffe been provided with a copy of these records?
No.
I think what I'm going to do is
for the witness.
Mr. Carlos, how long would it take you to go through these documents? Would you like to take a brief recess?
Certainly like to take a recess to review them.
Yes, and also if you could, I think you still need to review the earlier sound recordings that were delivered later here as well.
Yes.
Okay, do you want to reconvene at about 4:15, 4:30?
Okay,
4:00. All right, how much time do you need?
I don't know. I mean, I'll start reviewing them, and I'll try to be here, you know, by 4:15, but I might not be here till 4:30.
This is... Okay, we're going to go off the record, and we're going to reconvene at 4:30, okay?
4:15.
Excuse me. Well, 4:15.
How long will we go if we need to go to 6?
Well, you know, Mr. Abrams, what we're a little troubled at is here we are with documents again, and this is a rather, it's almost an inch thick. How soon did you get these documents?
Well, that's a fact. What you say is factually true, Mr. Camacho, but since yesterday, when we adjourned yesterday, I had to...
Did you get them at 10 o'clock this morning? 11 o'clock this morning? When did
10 o'clock this morning?
And only now does Mr. Cunliffe receive these documents on the eve of the testimony of this purported witness?
That's correct.
Okay, now I'm just going to remind you that one of the duties here is to preserve the due process rights of all the parties, and I don't think that Mr. Cunliffe has been given sufficient time. It would have been an easy thing.
I just received them myself. Could I explain?
Okay. Go ahead.
Wait, here's what happened.
You gave me the impression that you received them at 10 o'clock this morning.
Well, that's part of it, but I was not able to finish what I was going to say. And what I was going to say was my office issued the subpoena. The GTA representative was due at our office by 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock rolled around. We didn't see hide nor hair of him. We finally found out that he had delivered the documents to us at 9 o'clock, but nobody called from downstairs, and you know, one of these gov-gone things. So by 10 o'clock, the documents were in our hands, and what I had to do was give them to Mrs. Tang so Ms. Tang could see. What happened was she got the documents, what, at about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, something like that, and she jumped right. We worked through lunch to come up with the cover sheet, which is what we really can see, rather than go through all of the telephone records.
So you were summarizing the records, is that fair to say?
Yeah, the cover sheet does, and that would be the sheet that I use. It took a long time to...
Okay, I understand now.
I'm sorry, but...
Unless I'm going to allow Mr. Cummins a half hour to review the...
Sure.
That's okay.
Just for clarification for my own, okay, the number 4826904 is Josh Tenorio's cell phone number,
yes.
And then from the back you have extracted all the and there appears to be more than a dozen calls between October and February.
That's correct.
And then additionally on, and then the number 68806 is Tony Scos. And there appears to only have been one phone call.
That's correct.
So the majority of the calls on this, and this is a summary of the work
that's
you
correct.
Did, not GTA, and you extracted that from all of these other documents.
That's right.
Okay.
And it took a while because we had to go through a whole year.
Yes. Okay.
And we just took out the portions of it.
Well, let me give Mr. Cummins at least half an hour or so. We'll reconvene at 4:15, okay? And we're going off the record at 3:45.
Thank you.
I do.
Good. Okay. We're back on the record on OPA-PA-09-005. And Mr. Cummins, did you have sufficient time to go through the... at least the document concerning Ms. Doreen Chrysostomo?
I did. I went through it one of the numbers on mine for March 5th of 2009 appears in my document not to be the correct number, but...
Correct.
Okay, so that...
That confirms that, too.
Yeah, I think that confirms our review as well. And that would be the 671-482-0904 number from March the 5th, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And, okay. But generally, would you agree that's an accurate summary, Mr. Kummel, with the exception of that one number?
It's a summary from GTA.
Okay.
I understand that if the duration is 1 minute, it means it went to your voicemail.
Okay.
You didn't talk on the phone.
Well, rather than putting Ms. Chrysostomo on the stand again, would you stipulate to the entry of this document as an evidentiary exhibit?
As to phone calls that went from one number to the other?
Yes.
I have no problem with that.
What about... Beyond, that's good to have that stipulation, and that certainly speeds things up. But what I'd like to do is to ask her if there's anything about these phone calls that she can tell us about. In other words, there's an awful lot of telephone traffic going back and forth.
Okay, now, Mr. Edmonds, I think your offer of proof was the number of telephone calls, and hence the subpoenaing of the records from GTA, and here they are, and...
That's true.
Okay, and if we stipulate that, okay, these calls were made, and perhaps a number of calls...
But my offer of proof couldn't encompass her explanation as to what was talked about. And suppose she comes in here and she says, oh yeah, now that I see these records, I remember we talked about the RFP all the time.
And more importantly, how would that testimony, if elicited, be relevant to this appeal?
Well, you know, I've also wondered about that, and I contemplated that in before I cut the subpoena for Mrs. Chrysostomo, and Ms. Tang and I have also discussed this. And what we, you know, and there are a number of lawyers in the office with whom I've spoken about, what the distillation of all of that is that it's not going to, it's not a sink or swim issue as far as Mr. Cunliffe's appeal is concerned. In other words, you know, in one scenario, if Mrs. Chrysostomo would come out and say all kinds of things that she talked about leaked documents and whatever, even if she did that, it's not going to make the difference between your granting or denying the appeal that's pending. But what it does do is that it shows unclean hands. It could show that. And it could show that one of the reasons why GCIF knows what it knows about the other proposals is because they had a mole on the evaluation committee. And that's relevant. Is it dispositive? No. Is it relevant? Certainly it is. To show the mindset and the strategy of a major player in this appeal, which is Cortec. It shows that the GCIF president, Mr. Scrove, it looks like he made a call to Mrs. Chrysostomo. What did they talk about? I mean, if...
Was that the one call marked in green on your summary?
I think it was the one call, that's right.
One call that we had a lot of testimony about already, is that correct?
She didn't say that she received a call from Mr. Scrove, as I recall her testimony.
Like, as I recall, there was...
I didn't ask her that.
Testimony, I take that back. Yeah.
But, you know, it's a good question you asked, Mr. Camacho, and we also wondered about that. But in the balance, I think it's relevant. But I'm happy for you and the public auditor to decide if you need to know about these things.
Before we get into that as another preliminary matter, Mr. Cunliffe, were you able to go through those tapes?
No.
You weren't?
No, I just got through these and I came back here.
Taking a lot of time, though. Do you know if you need to call any other witnesses?
I don't at this point. As I indicated, I need to look at the documents, but if what Mr. Abrams has said exists on those tapes, it doesn't sound like they're going to provide me any information from which I could glean any more witnesses.
So you think that even reviewing the tapes would be unlikely? That you'd call
I have
any?
No idea. I mean, I'm, you know.
Okay.
I often take Mr. Abrams at his word, and often I don't. So, you know. I obviously have to listen to the tapes and see what is said to determine that. And then there's the other stack of documents that they gave me yesterday at 5 o'clock that I was going to review.
I'm trying to get to the point where the cases close and we go to closing arguments, okay? That's the main issue here. That's kind of the main gist of it. So how many minutes were those tapes?
Well,
Mr. Abrams,
the edited tapes would probably be about 5 minutes each.
5 minutes each? There's three of them, you say?
That's right.
So 15 minutes? Do you want to go to closing argument, Mr. Cumliff, or do you want to...
Well, I don't want to be here till 5:30 or 6 or 7 o'clock tonight doing that.
Well, I don't want to wait until the 15th of next month.
Well, we would have it a little sooner than the 15th. I'm looking
well,
possibly tomorrow.
I can get back, but I won't be here.
I understand that, but at the same time, I believe that Mr. Weisenberger is your co-counsel.
He's not available. He's got a hearing to go to tomorrow. That's why he can't be here today or tomorrow or Friday. I thought I had mentioned that earlier, but I could close today and let Mr. Ginn waive my presence at Mr. Cumliff's closing.
I'd like, let's see here. We had also given you, Mr. Cumliff, that time to go through those tapes.
But that was my understanding, that he was supposed to go and review the tapes in the 45 minutes that I'm also reviewing the phone records which were highlighted for convenience. So I think, you know, and I think everybody was advised that today was due for closing.
That's correct.
I understood to go look at these documents. I'm sorry, I didn't even figure out the tapes, because we had to call GTA to find out what these various notations meant, and it appears that about half of these calls were just voicemail contacts.
Okay, if we went off the record, do you think you can take the next 15 to 20 minutes to review the tapes and come back?
I can go back down and try to review the tapes. I got to make sure we have a tape recorder.
Yeah, we have one in our office.
Do we have the tapes here?
Yeah, we have our tapes here.
Okay, do you want to review them at our office, Mr. Cumliff?
Can I call my office and see if we have a regular? Is there the regular? I didn't open the regular cassettes, right?
I didn't open the regular.
Yeah.
The regular cassette?
Regular cassette. We have some kind of. We can transport him to our. Yes. Conference room.
Yes. Has anybody listened to them?
No. As a matter of fact, if you want to bring it up here, we can do it.
I'm sorry how audible they are.
We can.
We can watch. Once they bring their, they only have to review two because one of the stairs, right? They only want to listen to the other two. Why don't you bring
it? Okay, we're going to go off the record. I'm going to give Mr. Cumliff approximately 15 to 20 minutes to review the tapes. So we're off the record at 4.
When did you get our tape recorder?
3.
Okay.
Okay, so we're back on the record on OPA-PA-09-005. First and foremost, Mr. Cumliff, would you stipulate to the admission of this document concerning the phone records of Dorian Chrysostomo?
Yeah, I have no objection to it.
Okay. Mr. Abrams, I will allow the admission of this document, but I am going to deny your request to put Ms. Doreen Crisostomo back on the stand. I find the information that you proffered as evidence would be repetitive at best. Okay? So what exhibit number or what, how would it be, this would be exhibit one? Okay, so the summary of phone log for Doreen Crisostomo.
Well, we did incorporate the other exhibits at the substantial interest hearing by reference. So whether this would be a number one in a new sequence or I just want to make sure that you...
Well, what is, you have the responsibility for identifying your exhibit, Mr. Abrams. What is your exhibit number for this summary of phone log for Doreen Crisostomo?
Well, since we incorporated the other...
Could you speak into your mic, please?
Since we incorporated the other exhibits by reference, it's okay to use number one for this because I don't remember the last number in sequence of the other exhibits anyway. As long as the record's clear that we are incorporating the other exhibits by reference, then this can be number one.
All right, exhibit number one, which is a summary of phone log from Ms. Doreen Crisostomo, will be admitted into evidence. And could you please direct Ms. Crisostomo that she may be released from her subpoena?
Someone is doing that now.
Okay. And Mr. Cunliffe, on the second issue, were you able to play the tapes?
I was, and I didn't go very far into them, although I think the first one I listened to, there was some information, and then there was a break, and then there was some more information. And I listened a little bit into the subsequent tapes. I didn't hear any more information, so I wasn't going to sit there and listen to 2 or 3 hours to make sure they didn't. I don't know if there's something else on the tape that comes later, I think. I just didn't listen all the way, so...
That's consistent with Ms. Torres's...
I've listened to them, Mr. Cunliffe. They don't have much beyond what's said at the beginning.
Yeah.
But they don't have anything beyond...
I wasn't going to wait. I mean, I know somebody said at the end there might have been something, but I wasn't going to play it all the way through for an hour and a half.
And certainly, if that... isn't true in a timely manner by Friday, I hope you could file the appropriate motion. Okay.
Right.
Do you need to call any additional?
I don't believe, based upon the information that was contained in those, that I need to call any witnesses.
All right. Do you rest, Mr. Plummer?
Well, I haven't had a chance to review all the other documents they gave to me last night, which I thought you were going to give me a chance to review, which is about, you know, a stack about that thick of... record that I hadn't seen before because they never served it on me until last night at 5 o'clock.
What documents were you served?
They were the procurement record that was not...
Okay, but like I said earlier, that was actually with the Office of Public Auditor.
Well, I know there were a lot of documents with the Office of Public Auditor that, you know, I couldn't get access to, and this said... You know, I got something that said everything was privileged, so, you know, I presume they served me with what they were supposed to serve me with that wasn't privileged. And
you assumed?
I haven't reviewed them yet in any great length. I mean, some of them I looked at, I mean, if I agree with you, they're like the auditor's report, which isn't of the GovGuam Financial, which isn't going to provide any information, but...
Right, but at this time, you have no other witnesses?
I have no other witnesses based upon what I've reviewed at this point.
Okay. Mr. Abrams, you have no other witnesses?
No other witnesses. We rest.
Ms. Tang?
My time, thank you.
No witnesses?
No witnesses.
Will you rest?
Yes.
Okay, then pursuant to the October 13th, 2009 scheduling order, we are going to proceed with the closing statements of the parties. And as this is your appeal, Mr. Cunliffe, your client's appeal, you will go first.
The public auditor and the hearing officer have numerous documents which will have to be culled through to find out what the situation is with regard to this matter. We have not had the opportunity to review many of those documents and know what is contained in them, and that is no small task. That is now the burden of the public auditor and yourself to have to go through the de novo review of all of these documents that have been submitted. The issues that we have presented and the matters that have been brought forth in testimony provide that it is our belief that the offer that has been submitted, or the proposal that has been submitted by the IBC, is indeed not the best offer and was not the best offer, nor from the matters that have been testified to at this hearing could anyone have determined if it was the best offer. The parties made presentations, which tapes exist for this body to review as to what was presented to the evaluators for them to determine what was the best offer. And it was not lost on anyone, I don't think, that most of these people had nothing to review prior to going to those meetings. Some indicated they had the RFPs, but they didn't have the proposals themselves. And they had about an hour to review the proposals before they made a determination. In the questioning of certain of the evaluators, counsel for IBC brought out, and I presume this is she was talking about her client's proposal, because that would be the only one she would presumably have knowledge of, that there were different scenarios presented with regard to the finances. And that brings us to the question, well, what scenario were people voting on? If there are, in fact, different scenarios, how do we know which scenario was the best scenario and which scenario they voted on, and is that the scenario that is now subject to their negotiations? We believe that the amount of the proposed certificate of participation are for an amount of money that certainly exceeded the proposal submitted by GCIF, and according to an appeal, which is public record, by GEFF, it indicates their appeal indicates that the amount of the $69 million certificates of participation is significantly higher than their proposal for the project in question. The issue that was brought out both by myself and the public auditor with regard to Mr. Ntiako was that depending on what your bond rating or your rating, the public rating is with regard to these documents, these aren't bonds, they're certificates of participation, but they're similar, is what your interest rate will be. And of very great interest was, of course, Mrs. Limpiaco indicated that although she was not involved initially, it was her opinion as the counsel or the consultant to GITA that any rating that could be obtained on these certificates would be a B rating, which is one step below what Guam's normal rating would be, according to her testimony, based upon the funding source that was made available for this project. And of course, when you talk about a 30-year amortization, I believe the cost of the high school construction itself, because it has to be done in 9 months and therefore around the clock work 7 days a week, is about $32 to $35 million. And yet the funding proposals, as we believe them to be, range between perhaaps $150 to $200 million in ultimate cost of this project. And if the proposal or a proposal in the scenario, group of scenarios, from the selected bidder or selected proposer has gone up significantly from the time of the proposal to the time of the purported issuance of the certificates of participation, then there is no way that that proposal could, in fact, be considered the best proposal offered. The situation in regard to this matter, and what was of interest in the brief summation of the tapes, is that two of the proposers who were not selected as the initial offeror brought underwriters with them, already had procured underwriters to do any underwriting with bonds if necessary, but IBC did not. And it was quite clear from certain testimony that it took some time for IBC to obtain an underwriter to carry out their proposals. Now, the evaluators who were brought into this matter were very nice people, and they, certain of them had certain agendas. And I think as Affligui and the other members of DOE, all they really wanted was the building to be built as quickly as possible. I mean, not only did they testify here in these proceedings, but they testified during motion proceedings about what their desires were in that end. And we believe when you listen to the tapes that the questions that were brought forth by these evaluators, at least in the proceedings that my client was present in, were, can you save the tree? Can we have a courtyard? That there were not questions as to the financing, the value, the cost, and the like to determine what that exact situation would be. And I believe that the only witness who testified about asking questions about the financing was the Ms. Chrysostomo, or Mrs. Chrysostomo, who is the or was the financial officer for the Guam Public School System at the time, now DOE. And in that regard, Judge Manabusan, in a proceeding before the Superior Court, civil case 1787-00, indicated that the persons in charge of evaluating bid offerings should be an individual with some knowledge of the product which is the subject of the bid. And he was very concerned, and he admonished the agency that had selected those evaluators because the people did not have knowledge of the areas which they were selected to issue their evaluations on. In this case, the evaluation was of 70% of the value for financing this project. And the various statements of Ms. Tang during our previous argument was bonding documents are very complicated. They're not as simple as selling a house. And she went on to talk about the difficulty in understanding how they work and what the costs are going to be. And I think that the situation was one, and Ms. Chrysostomo specified her position that she had some concerns, and she didn't think the other people understood the financing aspects of these matters. And I guess when you have an opportunity to review the various proposals, you know, that may or may not come to fruition because we don't have those documents and we don't know what that is. But if in fact there are various scenarios of financing from IBC, how can they have selected IBC when we don't know what scenario that they were going to actually offer and what was being compared, apples and oranges or the various situations? And the outcome now is that the selection was made by people who were not qualified to do it, and it may have been made upon information which is completely different than the 69 point some million dollar certificates of participation. And I don't, I don't know, and I did not see what the interest rate on that $69 million was going to be, and we don't have that information, and hopefully it's before this body to determine what it is as compared to, was it, you know, $45 million at 5%, and now it's, you know, $69 million at 8.5%. I mean, I think clearly the situation is such that the documents and the decision as to who was the number one selected in a group or individuals is not accurate. We also believe that the offerors modified some of their positions, which were categories which you were graded upon between the time they were selected and the time that negotiations took place. And if that's in fact the case, then were the scoring accurate? If that position that they took at the time they were being scored is different, how do you take that into consideration in determining whether they've made the best offer or not in that regard? We've pointed out that there's a question about the negotiation of CAPFA being involved in these matters and attempting to enter into a lease when they do not have a license to be a landlord in the territory and lease this property back to the government of Guam for certainly millions of dollars a year. I mean, you know, $5 to $6 million a year, presumably, and to obtain their the money to pay off of these debts that are being incurred for the certificates of participation. And we believe that these proceedings have exhibited that, and often that the questions posed by the public auditor, certainly some very deficient issues with regard to the selection process and whether the ratings and the values that are now in place were the values upon which these selections took place. And we would ask this body to review that very carefully, and once you do, we believe that you will determine that this procurement was not proper and it has to be rebid. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cullough. Mr. Abrams?
Thank you, Mr. Camacho, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank both you and the public auditor for running a very effective hearing and procedure here. I'll just be very brief, and I would like to address the points made by Mr. Cunoff in his closing argument briefly. What I heard, and I think what we all heard just now, were points on appeal that never were the basis of the protest, that weren't contained in the protest. And I've said all along, and we filed legal authority to the effect that matters not in the protest can't be raised for the first time on appeal. And that would certainly apply to all this talk about CAPFA and leases and what happened at the evaluating committee level and whether the selection process was good or bad. None of that was in the protest and should be rejected out of hand. This thing about 90 days was not in the protest, but while we're on that subject, I would submit that any bid proposal that did not contain a guarantee of 90-day completion, nine-month completion is just invalid on its face, because that was an essential point of criteria contained in the RFP. So every bid would have to have a guarantee of 9-month completion, or else it's basically not on the table. I'm sorry? So, but this nine-month argument was not part of the protest either. So the closing argument, as the presentation on this appeal by Mr. Cunliffe, consistently raised matters which were at variance with the protest. So that's my first point. The second point is, you know, I'm not going to profess to be an expert on procurement law. I mean, I haven't specialized in that, but I don't think it takes an expert to make the point that inadequate, not the best offer. Mr. Cunliffe talks about IBC wasn't the best offer. Well, who is Mr. Cunliffe to judge whether IBC made the best offer or not? And not only that, whether or not IBC made the best offer is not an appropriate ground for an appeal. What is appropriate for a protest and then the ensuing appeal, if the protest is denied, is an infraction of the procurement regulations. We haven't heard that from Mr. Cunliffe. We haven't heard him say that paragraph so-and-so, section so-and-so of the Guam procurement law was violated. I never heard him say that, not once, not during his closing argument, not once during his appeal presentation, not in his protest. This is about the only procurement protest and appeal I ever heard of where a protester has not alleged a violation or an omission in terms of the procurement regulations. He comes before this agency and he says that IBC didn't make the best offer, so you're supposed to believe that and grant his appeal on that basis. He also talked about the qualifications of the evaluation committee members and whether or not they understood. All this is conjecture by Mr. Cunliffe. The evaluators, certain of them testified, and I think they're all credible with the one exception of Mr. Cunliffe's own witness, Doreen Chrysostomo, who she, whether it was deliberate or not, she definitely misled the OPA by saying that she received less than 5 phone calls, or there were less than 5 phone calls between her and Mr. Josh Tenorio, but we've got records that were stipulated to be admissible which show a multitude of telephone calls, and the telephone traffic, whether it were telephone calls or text messages or whatever, were hot and heavy between Mrs. Chrysostomo and Mr. Tenorio. And we can only, we don't know what was said in those conversations, but I think it's a safe assumption that a fair amount of it had to do with what Mrs. Chrysostomo knew or was supposed to know about the evaluation process and the presentations that were made to the evaluation committee. How do we know how much information was improperly gained by GCIF because of that? But that's not the issue. The issue is her credibility. And when she says things that are not true on the telephone calls, how much credibility are we going to give the rest of her testimony? And that's something for the hearing officer and for the public auditor to decide when they evaluate Mr. Cunliffe's appeal. So I would say that Mrs. Chrysostomo backfired all over GCIF as a witness because of her lack of credibility, basically, and I think we've overwhelmingly exploited that by these telephone records. I don't think you can believe a word she says. The last thing I want to talk about, and I said I'd be brief, and I shall. The last thing I want to mention is
the final documentation hasn't taken place. There's no final lease. There's no final financing agreement. There's no final anything. And there's been no final award. There's been no award at all, in fact. The Attorney General's office hasn't signed off on any of the proposed final documentation as being okay with us, as to approved as to form and legal content. We haven't done that. And so I won't say that the procurement procedure is embryonic. It's not. It's moved beyond the embryo stage. But I would say that it's still in the throes of being finalized. And so Mr. Cummins' allusions, when he alluded to what the final documents are going to be, is anybody's guess. We really don't know, because we haven't had a chance to conclude the procurement process, and we don't know what those documents are going to be. If and when the procurement procedure is finalized, and Mr. Cunliffe or any other bidder has a problem with what is disclosed after the award, they can certainly make a protest then. But it's premature to do it now because we don't have any final documents. Again, I want to thank the public auditor and you, Mr. Hearing Officer, for running a very fine procedure here, and the hearings have been well conducted. Thank you so much.
Ms. Tank.
Thank you. I'd like to address the standard review. I have two cases, and I did copy. The standard review in a for agency procurement action, I'm quoting from page 22 of the Black Water Lodge case, cited as 86 Federal Claims Court 48, page 23 of the printout, if you will, in the upper right-hand corner. An agency's action can be set aside if there has been clear and prejudicial violation of the law, or the agency's action lacks a rational basis. That's the standard. Has there been evidence of either a clear and prejudicial violation of the law, or DPW's action lacking a rational basis? The answer is no. If you go down the next paragraph, it's notes 4, 5, and 6, and 7. Courts grant procuring officers broad discretion in the conduct of procurement because of the strong presumption that government officials act correctly, honestly, and in good faith in considering bids. If the court finds that a reasonable basis for the agency's action, I'm skipping down to the bottom part of the quote, if the court finds that a reasonable basis for the agency's action, the court should stay its hand, even though it might, as an original proposition, have reached a different conclusion. Agency technical evaluations in particular should be afforded a greater deference by the reviewing court. That's the standard. And where today, the appellate, GCIS, has the burden of proof. They disappointed, and in the same case, in the next quotes, 8 to 13, a disappointed bidder bears the burden of proving error sufficient to justify relief. To prevail, the protester must show that there was a substantial chance it would have received a contract award, but for that error. The disappointed bidder's burden is elevated where the solicitation contemplates an award on a best value basis. It's clear that GCIS, as the appellate, has the burden of proof in going forward in establishing that there has either been a clear and prejudicial violation of the law, or that DPW's actions lack a rational basis. Let's review the evidence. There's been testimony from GITA confirming that IBC was prepared to meet the 100% financing requirement. There is no question in her mind that that would have happened had this protest not been filed. Vita would have done what it did for any other proposer. It submitted financial information in order to get the tax-exempt bond. There was nothing wrong with what Vita did. The crux of GCIF's protest was that IDC did not comply and cannot comply with the financing requirements and therefore should be excluded from the bid. There was no evidence presented in the last 2 days which supported this. Instead, they try to attack the evaluation process. And even in doing so, they did not, there was no evidence that there was anything wrong with the evaluation process. We had several evaluators testify, Ms. Dr. Gail Hendricks, Ms. James, Ms. Eunice Asterby, and Ms. Chrysostomo. These are all educated women who presumably could read amortization schedules and the documents. Each one of them were asked whether they needed additional time to review the documents before the presentation. And after the presentation, they were asked if they needed additional time or wanted to come back and score. And each one of them confirmed that they, while some of them said they wanted a little more time, they all said they were prepared to go forward. And until and unless everyone agreed, there was a unanimous agreement to go forward with the presentation. The testimony was, the evidence was that it did not go forward until there was unanimous consent. Ms. Chrysostomo, the attack on the evaluation, GCIF's attack on the evaluation rests on mostly the testimony of one witness, Ms. Chrysostomo. I think Ms. Chrysostomo's testimony has to be scrutinized for very good reason. She made numerous phone calls. We have a sheet. She testified that they were pulling teeth almost trying to find out how many phone calls she made with Mr. Tenorio, who was a key player, and after listening to the tapes, who was a presenter for GCIF. Even though he wasn't employed by GCIF, he's the contractor representative who ended up doing the presentation. And these communications with Ms. Chrysostomo happened on, I think, very, very, the timeline is very interesting. We know that the bid went out. There was a pre-meeting committee, a pre-proposal committee on December 16th. There we have a series of phone calls around that time frame, in December, mid-December. In January 8th, the proposals were submitted. Two phone calls on January 9th, 10 minutes each. Series of phone calls on 24th, 27th, 28th, end of January. I'm not clear, not clear what those phone calls were, but there were numerous communications during that period. Some were, may have been messages, but there are quite a few long phone calls, 13 minutes, 6 minutes, 10 minutes. So, and on March 5th, that's when GCIF received the ranking letter. On that day, there was a 4-minute call on March 5th. On March 1, GCIF received a phone call. Mr. Scro talked to Ms. Chrysostomo on that day. I'm sorry?
The March 5th one was the one that was not the phone call.
I'm sorry, okay.
That's the one we both confirmed.
I see, okay.
Okay.
But there were several phone calls in March around the time the rankings went out. And then later in April, and then of course, two very long calls in October 10th, about a week ago. the timing seems to tie to some of the procurement process, the timing of these phone calls. Is it coincidence? Probably not. She complained about the process. She complained about, she clearly has a strong tie to Mr. Tenorio and tried very hard to hide that connection during her testimony or minimize that connection. But I think her phone record proves otherwise. She claimed that the tables were so complicated. At the end, she said, well, they're amortization schedules. I don't think that one needs a degree to understand how an amortization works. We know the credentials of those other evaluators. They're all very intelligent individuals. And certainly, they didn't need to have a Bachelor of Finance or Accounting to understand how an amortization schedule works. Interest rates. GCIF complains about the interest rates. They argue that the interest rates are so complicated. The interest rates are an issue. You know, there are different scenarios. The RFP contemplated that. You can offer different interest rates, different scenarios. It was intended to be in the broadest, the statute allowed it, 29-114. It specifically allowed the broadest range of financing scenarios so that there would be as many offers, there would be more interested offers, proposals, so that it would be more competitive. And the scenarios are important to give an idea or flavor how things, but that is not the final deal. That's what happens during negotiations. That's after you negotiate, then you know the price, and then you go and either get your loan or get your money in the market, whatever your proposal requires. So there was nothing wrong in offering scenarios. No license, they argue. Their witness, Mr. Cruz, testified. They didn't have a license for lease, but that's not required. You're not required to get one until you actually sign a lease. The evidence shows that no lease has been signed. And even if CAFRA wanted, or IBC, or anyone wanted to get, the team wanted to go get a license, they wouldn't have been able to, because they didn't have the right to lease the land at that point. The evidence shows that IBC's team complied with the terms of the RFP and Public Law 29-114. This was a similar financing that was used in the Equity for School GESF case. In conclusion, the appellant, GCIF, simply has not carried its burden, and the denial of GCIF appeal by the procuring agency should be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cutler, if you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Camacho. Mr. Perez testified that all of these proposals were pre-screened by Public Works to see if they met all of the requirements. Mr. Abrams argued that I made some argument about 9 months completion. I didn't say a thing about 9 months completion during my argument, but the statement by Mr. Perez was all three of the proposals met all of the requirements, so I can only presume that they all agreed to complete this project in 9 months. Now, Ms. Tang cites some federal cases to tell this body and the public auditor what her standard of review is, but the Guam law says her standard of review is de novo. Ms. Tang is citing the court's standard of review, but by statute, the public auditor reviews this matter de novo. So that is an incorrect statement of the law. she cites that the testimony of Ms. Rimfiaco, who came into this matter after the presentations were made, when she was taking them to New York, that she was sure that IBC would have been able to get their financing. But the question is not whether they can get it in August of 2009. It was, did they have it available in January of 2009? They didn't even have an underwriter as part of their organization to say that, yes, they could get this funding. We're their underwriter, and we can do that for them. Indeed, it took them, I think, until June, according to the testimony, to even find an underwriter to do these things. And the government was busy doing other things, and they found apparently no other means of financing this project between January and June of 2009 on a project that has a very short leash. And for 7.5 months or so, no financing was even on the table. They argue that there were amortization documents, and they're not hard to read. Is there an amortization document for $69 million? I don't know. Is that in there? I don't know. But that's what they're offering at this point, apparently, a $69 million loan, which has to be paid back over 30 years. And what is the amortized total of that amount of money? What is the interest rate? They aren't maybe difficult concepts, but when you determine what the total amount of the loan is and what the interest rate is versus what it was you said you were going to provide in your financial offer in January of 2009, that's a different scenario. They make a lot of comments about Ms. Chrysostomo, and you will base your decisions on how you believe the witnesses. And, you know, Ms. Tang says, well, you know, in December, there were some phone calls, and Ms. Chrysostomo said she got appointed to be a evaluator immediately before the 15th when she had to go to the meeting. So the first 15 phone calls occurred before she was even an evaluator. How could they have discussed her position as an evaluator when nobody even knew she was going to be an evaluator? As I indicated previously, it's my understanding from GPA that if it's a one-minute duration, that's a call that went to your voicemail. And half of the phone calls went to voicemail. They weren't even conversations. As I indicated, we would acknowledge that this was her phone records, but it doesn't say she's the one who received or made the phone calls. Many people use other people's phones. Maybe it rings and somebody answers it, says she's not here right now, and hangs up the phone. I don't know what these are. She indicated that in January 15th, she told Mr. Tenorio that she believed that they weren't going to be ranked. Shortly thereafter, she had that information. I think the next day they got the rankings. There's no phone calls on the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th. In fact, the other phone calls are incoming calls. The first outgoing call that she made where there seems to be a conversation was January 30th. So, you know, in Guam, people know each other, people have friendships, and this is the only person who really had a financial background who asked any financial questions, and you'll be able to hear those financial questions that she asked on the tapes, I presume. And, you know, she's indicating with her financial background that she didn't feel, with all the tables and all of the graphs and all the information that was provided, which I haven't seen, that she thought it was too much information to digest. I don't think anyone would deny that bringing someone in who has no background in construction, no background in finance, no background in evaluating projects of this nature, to give them 1 hour to review some documents, have a presentation made, and ask a few questions, that anybody could make up a fair determination as to who was appropriate and who was inappropriate. That may be irrelevant according to Mr. Abrams, but it's a, you know, this is a 200 or 150 to 200 million dollar project that the government is entering into for the next 30 years. We believe that in the de novo review of this matter, that if what we have asserted is accurate, that this procurement must not stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cunliffe. We, just one slight correction. We did verify that the, as to the summary of the phone log of Dorian Chrysostomo, the last exhibit submitted by the purchasing agency was exhibit number 63. So we're going to title this as exhibit number 64.
That's fine.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So just for clarification, summary of phone log of Dorian Chrysostomo, that will be admitted as exhibit number 64 for the purchasing agency. Pursuant to the October 13, 2009 scheduling order for this hearing, the next item, the next deadline is essentially October the 30th of 2009 at 5 p.m. The parties may, but are not required, to file and serve on the other party's additional briefs on the issue of remedies. Okay, so basically it's a remedies brief. You may file one, albeit it's not required. Okay, and pursuant to the rules of the appeals regulations, procedures, we will issue a written decision within 30 days, and this hearing is now concluded. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Off the record at 5:44 p.m.